Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, edition 21. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's Sunday, May 17th, 2009, and today I'm at the end of the earth, coming to you from the studios of Hawaii Public Radio, right here in Honolulu. Ahead on today's program, we'll be talking about trouble in paradise and going it alone in the form of Hawaii's independence movement.
From 1900 until today, people were led to believe that Hawaii was a part of the United States, when in fact it wasn't. It's been so long, 100 years, our country has been compromised. That can't be tolerated.
That was Dr. Keanu Sai on Hawaii's right to sovereignty. We'll also be heading back east to the Motor City and digging into Detroit's new urban agriculture movement.
We're going to create the largest urban farm in the world, that we're not going to take no for an answer, that we believe in all things that can't be done. Detroit is at the right time in history with all of the things that are considered to be the right problems, and the economics work out for the first time ever to talk about something this bold.
That was Matt Allen, Senior Vice President at Hance Farms, Detroit. And Rob Bound is over in our London studio and will be playing us a bit of this later on in the show. That was The Key by Speech to Bell. In a few minutes, I'll be talking to Honolulu's mayor, Mufi Hanneman, about the opportunities for this U.S. city on Asia's doorstep. But before he joins me here, let's see who's back on our doorstep in London. Knock, knock, everyone. Who's there?
Surprise, surprise. It's Andrew and Rob.
Aloha.
Aloha. So there's actually a surprising amount of aloha that goes on in this state, in this city. You think from the outside that it's all a bit of a marketing hype and hoo-ha, but it's the real deal when you're here, let me tell you.
Have you had a lei and an Aloha shirt already?
I don't. I'm actually in my urban gear, and I was getting a few odd looks in the street, because en route to the studio, whatever ungodly hour it was here, most people already had their tops off, and everyone was in their Havaianas, except, of course, for a lot of the Japanese ladies who, of course, have these massive straw hats on, and they've got gloves on, and, you know, factor 150 so they don't get any sun.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're describing the studio here in London.
That's what I've got on. I can hardly reach the mic for my hat.
So how's all there, boys? I'm actually very jealous. I think I've got copies of the June issue chasing me around the world, because I thought I was going to get them in New York, and then I jumped to Los Angeles. We couldn't get them to L.A. And, of course, you've got this, it is quite a jump to get to Honolulu. So I think you're going to have to hand carry them to Tokyo, Andrew.
I'm looking forward to kind of traveling the opposite direction almost immediately after the show, kind of coming from here to Tokyo to see you there. But it looks good. We're very, very chuffed to kind of see it. And it's one of those funny things when you've sent it, and there's so many late nights and so many kind of, you know, decisions made. Until you see it in your hand, you're never 100% sure what it's going to look like and exactly what it's going to feel like. And it just feels great. It's a really kind of packed, fat, solid issue. It's really wonderful.
Well, I don't want to hear about your interview with the Estonian PM anymore, but what are some of the other standout stories for you in the issue?
Well, apart from the Estonian PM, there's quite a nice story from Fiona, which kind of fascinates me, which is part of our farming theme, which where she's looked at Omi beef, which in Japan, Kobe beef, which has now gone global as a brand, is successful. But in fact, if you were Japanese, the brand of beef, or the kind of beef that you would select, would be Omi beef. And she's gone to the region where this is grown, harvested, however you describe it. And we actually have, as Rob was pointing, a rather abrupt picture from cow to plate on our page. What's good is that she describes how, you know, Japan is just by sticking to its kind of, you know, core values of farming has managed to kind of create these amazing kind of brands that have gone global. So Wagyu beef, Kobe beef, you know, we know those names. But here's another kind of beef that is kind of set to go global, because all the kind of top restaurateurs from New York are heading to one region to see these amazing kind of cattle and to kind of, you know, buy up the beef.
Rob, what stood out for you?
My lead story in the culture section was about the entertainers. We call them the entertainers.
Oh, I was asking about the rest of the issue. This wasn't the All About Me hour.
Oh. Well, I was only a small part of this story, actually. I thought I was going to plug the work of some of our other fine editors.
Go on, tell us about your story.
I'm sorry. And so the entertainers are the sort of untold, unheard of, but very profitable and big business sector of the music industry, that aren't number one or aren't number anything in the charts and aren't selling records, but travel the world, playing the piano in hotel lobbies. They're the jazz quartet in your sort of local hotel bar. These are the kind of the untold stories of the unsung singers, really. And it's an amusing and quotable story, I think, at least that. And another thing I really liked, actually, was a story that Fiona did for us on wine manga, which is a kind of amazing specialism of manga. Obviously, we have the manga section in the magazine, which is this partnership, a husband and wife team of manga writers that specialise in wine and seem to be sort of biggest megastars in manga in Japan, and basically spend 3 days a week drinking, 2 days a week writing, and I think a sort of policy that we should adopt at Monocle immediately. They wear dark glasses every day of the week, and I asked Fiona why.
When I was looking at the layouts, they look like an incredible pair, and they wait so that they've fully polished up one bottle before they get into writing their next story.
Yeah, exactly. I know. They've always got a tube of toothpaste in their top drawer just in case they've got black teeth or red teeth.
Andrew Robb, we're going to be catching up with you a little later in the program. Now, U.S. state capitals, indeed national capitals, rarely come quite as remote as Honolulu, Hawaii. To put things in perspective, it's a 5-plus-hour flight from Los Angeles, it's over 8 hours to Tokyo, and there are no nonstop flights to Europe. Despite being rather out of the way, it's also a sizable piece of real estate on Asia's doorstep. With a local economy that relies heavily on tourism and also a massive military presence, we wanted to know how the city is responding to the economic and political shifts on the far side of the Pacific. Joining me in the studio to answer that and a bit more is Honolulu's mayor, Mufi Hanneman. Welcome.
Great to be here. Aloha.
Thank you. This really strikes me as land of opportunity. Here we have a state capital. You practically have a U.S. state sitting on Asia's doorstep, as we were saying in the introduction. What's being done here? And when I say what's being done from an infrastructure point of view in terms of attracting new talent, and perhaps not just talent from the other 49 states, but elsewhere in the world, where do you see Honolulu going?
Well, we're very fortunate to be in a situation where we are indeed the bridge between East and West. We are not part of the continental U.S., yet very much a part of it, being the 50th state of America. And we take full advantage of the fact that we have a multi-ethnic population that comes from all parts of the world. Tourism is obviously our number one industry. We like to feel, however, that we're more than sun, sand, sea, and surf in the spirit of aloha, that we're a great place to vacation as well as do business. And one of the very little known facts is we're actually the 12th largest municipality in the United States. Oahu, where the city and county of Honolulu is located in my jurisdiction. So when you talk about infrastructure, our biggest impediment to a better quality of life is the amount of time our people spend stuck in their cars in traffic, no different than other sprawling metropolitan cities throughout the world. And what we are prepared to do is build a light rail transit system. We want to break ground in 2009 in what has been described as one of the best transit projects in America. It's going to reduce the amount of time we spend in our cars. It's going to enable us to build out what we call transit-oriented development, where around train stations we'll have affordable housing, commercial, retail opportunities. And I really believe that it'll bode very well for us in the future. It's no question in my mind, in order to have a very good visitor industry, not only have to have a beautiful place for people to come and visit, obviously your attractions have to be very appealing, but your infrastructure also has to be maintained and secondly, or enhanced. And secondly, you have to make sure that your place is a safe and secure city. We've always been blessed with a great natural environment. Well, another little known fact about Honolulu, we are rated by the FBI as the safest big city in America.
Well, that's one of the reasons why you rank as the number one U.S. city on our global quality of life list, for that very fact. And we often get a lot of heat at Monocle because people say, well, yeah, there's a number of great cities in the United States. Miami has great connections to the rest of the world. It sits on Latin America's doorstep, but we always have to counter saying, but your crime statistics, they might be improving, but they still ain't great. And that's the one incredible thing when you look at this city is that your crime statistics, as you say, and with the endorsement of the FBI, it's quite astounding.
Well, we work at it. We have one of the finest police departments in the nation, the Honolulu Police Department. Our fire department is also nationally accredited. Our lifeguards are nationally certified. And we have a family of first responders that are second to none. And I've always said the most important job of a mayor of any city throughout the world is to ensure public safety. And when you have an economy that is very dependent on tourism, if they feel that this is not a good place or a safe place to visit, they will not come. If they feel that our infrastructure is in disrepair, they will not come. So this is why I place great emphasis in promoting our visitor industry, not necessarily just marketing the city, but also making sure that when they get here, they'll have a pleasant experience. They'll be able also to enjoy our culture. This aloha spirit that we call, and we've been able to basically market to the world, is something that I'm sure every culture, every city has, their own brand of spirit of aloha, but something very special about visiting our islands. That's why Oprah Winfrey has a home on the island of Maui. That's why Elvis Presley came here and filmed several films here. You know, many leading artists, musicians, entertainers, and high-profile personalities come here. Our own President Obama visits us at least twice a year, and he did that even before he was the President of the United States.
It's one thing to have entertainers who come and visit here and spend time and build great houses, but what about keeping them here all year round, or at least for a good part of the year, building studios, making sure that you have a vibrant... I don't want to just play on the whole creative community thing, because every U.S. city wants to have a creative community now. But this seems like one of the better cities suited to develop that.
Yes, and I've always said we are a great place to vacation and to do business. And I think one of the things that we try to promote here is our multi-ethnic population. You can find people here who have European origins. You can find people here who have Asian origins. You can find people here who are from the greater part of Oceania. And they speak the language, they know the culture, and people feel very comfortable here. The reason why Japanese investment, in my opinion, took off in America and the Western world is it came to Hawaii first. They felt comfortable, they invested it, they got adapted to the Western culture here in America, and then they spread out from here. And I really believe that could hold true with China, with Vietnam, with Korea, with Taiwan, especially with the easing of travel restrictions that has limited a lot of foreign travel to the United States.
Has the face of travel to this city changed? I mean, you know, obviously not a great time to talk about Mexico at the moment, but of course, you know, Mexico certainly, you know, over the past few decades has probably challenged you on some level, certainly with people in search of a cheaper holiday. And, you know, it's not so expensive to go to Thailand anymore either. So I'm wondering how you've had to change your game in terms of attracting at least tourist dollars. But my second question is, how will you look at and what will you do with the city to also make it attractive to people in Seoul, in Taipei, in Ho Chi Minh City?
Well, I think what we've tried to do is, number one, is we're still resisting the temptation to embrace gaming. I still believe that that's not the path for Hawaii, maybe for other destinations, but certainly not for Hawaii. We still haven't, in my opinion, scratched the surface on the potential for ecotourism, cultural tourism, edutourism, health tourism. I still believe that we could still promote ourselves as the Geneva of the Pacific, where people can come here and hold conferences, hold summits that will take advantage of our weather, obviously, and our people here, but at the same time do it in a very peaceful setting.
What's fascinating is, I know it's a topic we'll cover later on in the show, is how much the mayor feels you're kind of benchmarking yourself against other American cities, or do you look to Asia the way you're benchmarking? It's interesting the way you talk about Hawaii. How much do you feel just another American city, or do you feel that Hawaii does feel like a completely separate entity in the kind of the challenges you're facing and both the kind of opportunities you face as well?
That's an excellent question and observation, I might add. We see ourselves very much part of America, but we think we're the most unique city in America, simply because we've had a monarchical past. We're very proud of the fact that our indigenous Hawaiian culture remains very much a part of us. And whether you've lived here for 1 year or 50 years, you embrace the Hawaiian culture. You come here, you start wearing the aloha shirts. It's part of what we do every day. Probably only the mayor wears a coat and tie every day except Friday. But in that context, I think that's what makes us very unique and very appealing, that, you know, we're not just another Miami or Los Angeles or San Francisco, Boston. You come here, it's the spirit of aloha, the way we greet you, the way we embrace you. And so we're sophisticated in some aspects, but I think we're very caring, down-home people that embrace cultures from all parts of the world. And sometimes that has been a problem for us because we've been taken advantage of. And this is why we have to create that balance. I take great pride in the fact that I'm the first native-born mayor in over 40 years. Most of our mayors who have been elected in the past 40 years have been born and raised in the mainland. They've moved here. And so we've had a culture here that basically has been very reticent to step forward, to take leadership sometimes. And that's why we are very, very proud of Barack Obama, because he came here when he was 8 years old, graduated from high school here, and he's never lost sense of what Hawaii is all about. In fact, the First Lady, Michelle Obama, has said quite emphatically, to understand my husband, you've got to appreciate his ties, his relationship with Hawaii.
And will you talk about, over time, you know, having been taken advantage of, is now this the time to take advantage of Washington with the right person in the right house?
Absolutely. Why not? And, you know, we're very proud of the fact that You've got an Obama in the White House with strong Hawaii ties. You've got a senator now, a sitting U.S. senator who has the most powerful committee that he chairs, who's from Hawaii. That's Senator Dan Inouye, who's been a member of the U.S. Senate since 1962. We also have our first individual with a Hawaiian background as a member of the president's cabinet, and that's the Secretary of Veterans Affairs in General Eric Shinseki. So it's a wonderful time for us. I want the rest of the world to look at us as not just a place to come and vacation, as I said earlier, but a place to invest, to do business, to develop these public-private partnerships that will allow Hawaii to share its expertise. We say we share our mana'o, that's a Hawaiian word for knowledge, our wisdom with the rest of the world. That's my goal. I want our young people who sometimes have a tendency to leave Hawaii after they graduate because they say, you know, if I want to work there, it'll just be in tourism or I have to run for office, so let me leave. I want them to come back here and help take Hawaii to the next level. There's so many hidden secrets about us. And I think I've tried to utilize this wonderful show with you today, and that's why I thank Monaco for rating us as high as they do, because there's a great quality of life here that if people want to come and do things, as we say, local style, Hawaii style, we embrace you. We say to you, e komo mai, welcome to our community.
Great. Mayor Muffy Hanuman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you.
Aloha.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from Honolulu and London, and we're back after this. Welcome back. Now, independence movements are nothing new to the United States, and there are no shortage of groups, both radical and placid, that keep various branches of the FBI and ATF up at night. While Hawaii has a variety of sovereign groups keen on seeing the state go its own way, Dr. Keanu Sai thinks that the state's future lies in exposing and fixing the annexation of Hawaii at the end of the 19th century. Currently about to publish a book on that topic, Dr. Sai is with me here in the studio. You have a slightly different take on the whole notion of sovereignty and certainly how there needs to be some sense of self-determination on these islands. Maybe put it in context for us first.
Well, I think before we can look at sovereignty today, we need to understand what is sovereignty within the framework of international law, and if Hawaii, in fact, already had sovereignty, and it did, since 1843. On November 28, 1843, Queen Victoria and King Louis-Philippe jointly recognized Hawaii as a sovereign state. Now, as a sovereign state, from 1843 to 1893, Hawaii had over 90 embassies and consulates throughout the world. Embassy in London, and the British had an embassy in Honolulu. Now, what took place in 1893 was an illegal overthrow of the Hawaiian government. It was as a result of an illegal intervention by the U.S. Marines, with the purpose of overthrowing the government and then propping up a puppet government to travel to Washington, D.C. and sign a treaty of cession, transferring all of Hawaii to the United States. That did not work well. Incoming President Grover Cleveland did an investigation and determined the entire episode was illegal in accordance with international law and entered into an agreement with the Queen where they settled the dispute, where he would, as President of the United States, restore the government back to what it was before the U.S. troops landed, and the Queen would grant amnesty to those individuals who committed high treason. From 1893, you might just say we had the non-compliance to that agreement. And in 1897, a second attempt to annex Hawaii by treaty took place in 97, and another treaty was signed by these same individuals, but because of political activism by Hawaiian subjects and the Queen, and protests filed with the U.S. State Department, the Senate could not ratify that treaty. Instead, during the Spanish-American War in July of 1898, United States Congress unilaterally seized Hawaii by enacting a joint resolution of annexation, an American law limited to U.S. territory. Nevertheless, they used that law to justify the occupation of Hawaii, and from that point, Hawaii's sovereignty was hidden, and it was treated as if it was colonized. And from 1900 until today, people were led to believe that Hawaii was a part of the United States, when in fact it wasn't. So my work, especially from a political science standpoint, using international relations and public law, it's able to provide an appropriate lens to interpret this very complex issue. And you quickly begin to realize Hawaii never lost its sovereignty. It still exists.
So tell me, how do you position yourself differently within the political arena of Hawaii versus, let's say, the current sovereignty movement? Would you say that you're both aligned? I mean, obviously, there's a philosophical difference because you're talking about a continuity here,
right,
that it never went away. Are there sort of certainly, you know, different tools that both sides are playing with?
Well, these two concepts are mutually exclusive. You can't be sovereign and non-sovereign at the same time. You're either a sovereign state or you're not. It's something falsifiable, and it's a legal analysis. Yeah. But when you look at the sovereignty movement today, they're operating on the assumption that Hawaii was annexed to the United States and then entertaining the idea of secession or possible secession or autonomy within the United States as a possible status like an American Indian tribe. All of that is based upon the fiction that has existed here since 1898. Now, when you start to look at the law as it existed prior to 1898, meaning the illegal annexation of Hawaii, clearly it shows that Hawaii is a sovereign state. Its sovereignty was never transferred. So what we have here is, the best way to say it, the Matrix. You remember the Matrix? This is Matrix 1. There are two worlds. And if you take the red pill...
Is this why your name is Keanu?
Actually, Keanu Reeves is my cousin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he and I were named after my grandfather.
He went to my high school in Toronto.
Really?
Yeah,
he and I were actually the same age. We used to play together when we were young.
Okay.
When he used to travel from Canada to Honolulu.
Right.
Yeah, so he and I were named after my grandfather, Henry Keanu Reeves. My mom is a Reeves. That's her maiden name.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's part Hawaiian.
Right, so he's potentially going to be your poster child in time.
Well, I don't want any poster child. I want scholarship. And right now I'm a political scientist. So what I try to do is maintain the rationality behind this very complex and volatile and emotional issue. This information is very complex, but yet it's very understandable within the framework of international law. When you start to expose that within the international community, people start to understand Hawaii in a very different way.
Is your movement, and certainly the current thinking around your course, is it gaining currency?
Absolutely. PhDs now are stepping up to the plate, and they're shifting their, you might say, their hypothesis. At first, it operates on the assumption that Hawaii is a part of the United States. Let's entertain the idea of breaking away. When you apply a new hypothesis with the backdrop of the theory of international relations and Hawaii's continuity, it presents a very different picture. All of a sudden, Hawaii begins to look like the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Looks like Iraq, minus the violence. It looks like Afghanistan. What is important in Iraq is that with the overthrow of a government, which took place in 2003, that did not equate to the overthrow of Iraq as a sovereign state. All that was eliminated was the government itself, which exercises that authority. The same thing happened in Hawaii. Our government was illegally overthrown. The president and the queen settled the dispute. He's supposed to restore that government, and the queen was to grant amnesty. So when we're talking about sovereignty, it never left. What we're talking about is 100 years of indoctrination that we were led to believe that actually sovereignty was transferred when it wasn't.
It's interesting. This is really a follow-up to a story that we did back in issue 14. And you told us at that time, and I quote here, "Our main goal is to expose occupation and bring it to an ultimate end."
Right.
What does that ultimate end look like?
Restoration of the Hawaiian government back to its status before 1893. The treaties that it had with foreign countries are still intact today. Foreign trade will come directly into Honolulu Harbor or other designated ports. What we're looking at is, and again, this is not my choice. Restitution, it has to go back to what it was, meaning it has to be restored back to the legal status it was. Now, once you go back to that legal status, then it's up to the people of this country to take it into the future. I'm not promoting the future. What I'm doing is I'm looking at the past. And the past is providing a very, very extreme case of prolonged occupation. When we're in the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, arguing this case, Lance Larson versus the Hawaiian Kingdom, we had three prominent arbitrators on the panel. Professor James Crawford, he's the Dean of Cambridge University. We also had Professor Greenwood from the London School of Economics and Political Science, and also Gavin Griffith from Australia. Both Gavin Griffith and Greenwood are Queen's Counsel. When they sat on the panel, what was, I think, a shock for them was the history they did not know of Hawaii. But the fact that we were in the Netherlands, in The Hague, is profound. That the case was heard and our decision, the arbitration award, was published in the International Law Reports out of Cambridge. Now, while we were in the Netherlands, we did receive a call from the Rwandan ambassador assigned to Brussels, Dr. Bizo Hagara. And he said he had important information to share with us. So we traveled from The Hague, caught the train. A motorcade picked us up at the train station. We met the ambassador in a little cafe. He was in a meeting with the African Union. So went into a little cafe, and he said that they reviewed all the records from the pleadings in the court, and that Rwanda is prepared to report to the United Nations General Assembly the prolonged occupation of Hawaii. That he said this is a violation of international law and cannot be tolerated. Now, what drove the Rwandan ambassador and the Rwandan government to do such a thing? I can only assume it had to deal with the genocide that took place in Rwanda and how nobody came until it was too late. And that's why he said this prolonged occupation of Hawaii cannot be tolerated. Well, we were very ecstatic with the offer, but we knew that what he read and his government read in our legal proceedings did not match what our people understood back home. Education was crucial. So we decided to thank the Rwandan ambassador, but say no thanks. With all due respect, we did not want to put the Rwandan country in a precarious situation, possible political retaliation, when they're going to represent Hawaii, and Hawaii can't even stand on its own. What I did was I decided to come home, and I was decided with the legal team I was with that I would enter the University of Hawaii to begin that re-education.
with all due respect to the Rwandans, had it been a bigger state sponsor, had it been Canada, would it have potentially been a yes at that cafe in Brussels?
No. Our people weren't ready. And it's back in 2000.
Sure.
Yeah. Till today, that education is so instilled of American presence that we need to present it in a very educational way so that it gets away from the idea of emotions and race and matters that really have nothing to do with the law. So it was important, no matter who recommended, that we need to begin the re-education. It's been so long, 100 years, our country has been compromised. That can't be tolerated. But how do you deliver that is key. How do you present it? And I'm a very respectful person. You know, there's a way of delivering, yeah? And what I do carry also is, as a Hawaiian, not because it's my race, but just the way I was brought up, I have aloha. I have responsibility. But also don't mistake aloha for being weak. It's a way and it's an approach. But I think it's very promising. But I think just as Barack Obama needs to be reeducated, so does everyone in the world. And that's why it's very important for me to pursue the PhD in political science to ensure that there is analytical rigor. This is not a platform for politics, but rather the foundation of a prolonged occupation and how to bring it to an end.
Dr. Kianosai, thank you very much for joining us.
Mahalo.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Up next, over to London for a bit of culture. You're back with The Monocle Weekly, where I believe Rob has a bit of culture for us back in the London studio. Do you have a bit of culture, Rob?
How much do you want?
I don't know, because I have none here. I was hoping actually to get to a record shop. Actually, I was rather disturbed when I was at the concierge desk this morning. I said, what is the best independent bookstore in Honolulu? And they said it was run out of town by Barnes & Nobles and Borders. No. So I'm hoping that I can find a good independent record shop and I can play some Hawaiian music next week.
Absolutely, yeah, right back at you style.
So what do you have for us?
Well, this afternoon we have a girl called Speech de Bell, which sounds like it should be the name of a song, but it's her name. And her album is called Speech Therapy. She's a 23-year-old Londoner, and she recorded this track and this album in Melbourne to give it a bit more of a laid-back sound. And it's rap music, essentially. It's hip-hop, but it's got a wonderful kind of spacey feel. And all the instruments on this track and on this record are all sort of played. They're all proper instruments, proper percussion, proper woodwind, as you're going to hear on this track, which is called The Key. I hope that mean you learn to slow your roll and keep your mouth closed. A proper attitude is better than fancy clothes. So as the chapter closed, that's how the story goes. As I've grown, I've learned that friends turn a foe. I heard you got your yard now, when you grow now. It's not arms out, cause I overstand, yeah. Overstanding is the key, key. Overstanding is the key, key. I heard you got your car now, I see you out town. It's not arms out, cause I overstand, yeah. Overstanding is the key. It is a bit laid back. I wonder if that's an opportunity for Honolulu to become a recording center as well. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, you should be hanging out with Jack Johnson and his Brushfire Records, which I think are based in Hawaii, aren't they?
Have you ever been here?
I have not. No, I haven't.
I think you would really like it. And when I was talking to the mayor earlier, it does strike you that there's probably no shortage of people. I mean, not just in the United States, but I think all over the world who would love to have some type of creative hub here because, yeah, it is a bit of a schlep to get back to London. But, you know, the great thing is LA is 5 hours. And if you want the Asian markets, you know, to get to Taipei and certainly to get to Japan and Korea, you know, it is incredibly close. And you think, what a great base this would be. I mean, you know, in no small part because it's, you know, it's an English language hub.
Exactly. Well, it's actually funny because while you were saying that, I was just redrafting my contract and and it's all on there. No, it sounds wonderful. I think it is one of those places which...
And I think that's the sound of Andrew's lighter as well as he burns it.
Yeah, I think we need the fire extinguisher in here.
He's going nowhere.
Or something.
Well, I hope you enjoyed a bit of speech anyway, Tyler.
I did. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back. Now, if there's a poster child for urban decay and mismanagement in the mayor's office in the U.S., then it's Detroit that leads the pack. With once vibrant neighborhoods returning to the lens simply because they're overgrown and ungoverned, it's not surprising that Detroit is about to become home to the largest urban agriculture project in the world. Is this just a suburban garden allotment gone supersize, or does it represent a bigger opportunity for urban centers around the globe? Well, joining me on the line from Detroit to tell us more is Matt Allen, Senior Vice President of Hance Farms. Welcome. Just to kick off, what was the genesis for the idea? And was it just a case of looking around and seeing all of these vacant lots in Detroit, you know, and certainly a city, you know, perhaps since you even had the idea, that is increasingly down on its luck, that prompted this?
I think that driving past the urban blight that has been Detroit for the past 40 years wears on a man after a while, and it kind of gives him a motivation to do something about it at some point. You think that year after year after year, that sooner or later somebody, whatever that somebody is, will do something about it. And most people think that means government. Somebody's going to do something about this. And yet the problem gets worse and worse. And with the global economic downturn in the last few years, Detroit has really been the tip of the spear, at least in North America, for the quick downward spiral of the housing market and so on, which has really created some really acute problems here. Having looked at that for my entire life of almost 44 years, being a native Detroiter, as well as John Hance, the founder of Hance Group, and the man that who shares this vision with me to create the largest urban farm in the world, we decided that first and foremost was we need to do something about that problem, that thing we see every day that we drive past it from our house to the office. And we thought about how do we get this cleaned up? And then it blossomed into a three-hour conversation a year ago in his backyard, and it turned into we're going to create the largest urban farm in the world, that we're not going to take no for an answer, that we believe in all things that can't be done, and that Detroit is at the right time in history with all of the things that are considered to be the right problems, and the economics work out for the first time ever to talk about something this bold, which is to do mass consolidation of land into farming pods and clusters and put them into productive use, put them back on the tax rolls, and provide healthy, local, and fresh, safe food for people in southeastern Lower Michigan.
Matt, if you could paint a bit of a picture for us, and you, of course, mentioned urban blight at the outset. Detroit is no longer a pretty town. It still has some very handsome-looking suburbs. Are we talking about one unified parcel of land, or is the idea to use vacant lots all over the city that will, you know, obviously be growing potatoes in one place and tomatoes you know, during the summer months somewhere else? What will this look like when we go through Detroit, whether it's an 18-month time or 3 years' time?
The city, over many years with the tax structure and so on, has driven a lot of businesses out. A lot of people just chosen to walk and make a better financial decision and do business elsewhere. So we've had a lot of flight. The city of Detroit was designed to hold 2 million people. It's 139 square miles. In 1957, we peaked out at 1.8 million people, and we've been on a downward slide ever since. And there's been a lack of political will and leadership. There's been a lack of synergy between the suburbs and the city, between black and white. There's a lot of systemic problems here which have allowed this horrible decay to take place. So there's pockets of large clusters of land that have been vacated or gone to foreclosure and turned into government hands. And then there's onesies and twosies stretching through lots of neighborhoods. Detroit is kind of like a checkerboard that way. Once it was the fourth largest city in the United States, one of the wealthiest in the world, because of the juggernaut of mass manufacturing of automobiles. And it's just not been the case for the last 30 years for sure. So we have neighborhoods that are suffering. We have whole large areas of a depleted population. And I say that meaning that we have areas where there's 0 to 9 people per acre in the 11th largest city in the United States. That's bizarre. You don't see that anywhere
That's
else.
That's extraordinary.
So we're looking at those areas to create large clusters. We easily see several acres as only as small as 50 acres. That's just a starter. There's one area we're looking at right now that it's over 600 acres. It's almost one square contiguous mile that we could start farming within 12 months.
I have to ask, though, as a former resident of a very large city up the 401 highway up in Toronto, you are also a city which has not been blessed with the best weather in the world as well. So while you can say that science will dictate what you grow, I just have to ask a very direct question. What are you going to grow? Because, you know, there are many months when you're buried under a hell of a lot of snow.
Very true. The climate in Toronto is very similar to the climate here in southeastern Lower Michigan. And some of the things that are going on in Ontario are some of the things we plan to adapt right here in the Metro Detroit area. There's hoop structures, which the urban research that's being done through Michigan State University are these hoop structures where you can have 11 months of sustained harvesting. You may not be able to grow a full 12 months doing this northern climate without utilizing heated structures, which we don't plan to use. But you can harvest for 11 months out of the year. And by staggered growth, you can maintain greens and things like that inside these hoop structures, which are covered and protected from the extreme cold elements that is this mid-December through the 1st of March. But you can still harvest things. In other words, things will be grown to a certain point and they'll go dormant, but they're still fresh. You can cut them and wash them and prepare them as if you would in the middle of the summer.
So what does Detroit become in your mind as a lifetime resident? When you look back, you know, over 4 decades, you know, as you said, this was a city, was once upon a time the fourth biggest city in the United States, one of the wealthiest in the world. It was very much an urban hub. We're now moving to an there'll be obviously a significant agrarian component to it. What happens, though, to the urban fabric? How do we actually weave all of this in together so there's also a sense of, or at least that there is some sense of urban pride again?
Cities are all about density, as you know. And in order to have the most cost-effective servicing and so on, you have to have full blocks of people and so on. And what we see is irregularly formed farm clusters whereby the new city, the post-industrial Detroit, can be recreated. We are going to be a sustainable city of the future. And we see these farming pods as vehicles to create anchors for future growth around us. So it won't be the conventional wood-clabbered and brick-veneered housing of the 1920s. We'll be creating new neighborhoods in around these farm clusters for sustainable communities.
I thought I heard the sound of a tractor being revved up in London. Andrew, is that you with your bulldozer? Are you about to clear a plot of land to do the same in the UK?
It's me and also Rob. I think I've got one quick question and then I think Rob's going to leap in with one as well, if you don't mind. I was fascinated. Just one tiny question. Is Hants Farms a private company? Do you get your money from the state or do you generate your money yourself? But a bigger question was, do you think there's a point actually when, Matt, we should actually think about just abandoning cities, you know, in the way that the kind of the ghost towns of the Gold Rush, for example, were abandoned when that kind of period of industrialism passed or that period of wealth passed? Do you think that this is actually a time when it's a scary thought, but is there an argument actually just made to be made for abandoning Detroit?
Oh, no, not at all. We're a very vibrant cultural center. That, you know, the history here is quite rich. You know, we've been around for 300 years. The city has burned before. We've risen up from the ashes in various forms. You know, we've had, you know, the great benefit of, you know, reaping the rewards of mass manufacturing. It was perfected here. It's still headquartered here. We're on our knees at the moment. That is that aspect of our community, automobile manufacturing. But it'll rebound. It'll never be the same. We all know that. The period that we're living through right now is permanently altering the dynamics here in Detroit. But I don't think Detroit will ever go away. And to answer your question, yes, this is private, but we're doing this in conjunction with public entities who are holding on to this land because we feel in order to get it back on the tax rolls, it needs to go into private hands. That's the best way to do it because if you put it into nonprofit hands, they don't generate tax revenue.
Matt, hi, this is Rob in London as well.
Hi, Rob.
I think you paint a wonderful picture of a sort of J.G. Ballard landscape where broad beans are growing through the concrete floors of Chrysler factories. But how are you going to retrain the staff? Are people that were screwing hubcaps on Buicks going to be tilling the fields?
That's a very good question because the guys that are screwing hubcaps onto Chrysler 300s right now are making somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 an hour plus UAW benefits. I can't afford to pay them that. But will there be room for people who have been locked out of the system, so to speak? The 22% of Detroiters, people who live within the city limits of Detroit that are part of the permanent underemployed or unemployed? I think so. I don't have to bring migrant workers here. We've got plenty of people that are looking for employment right here.
Matt Allen of Hants Farms in Detroit, an amazing project. Best of luck.
Thank you so much, Tyler.
Thank you. Wow, well, he certainly does have his work cut out for him, don't you think, Andrew?
It's extraordinary. When you think of Detroit, you think of one of the biggest cities in the world. And when he says there's only going to be 800,000 people living there in quite a short time, you realize how these American cities are shrinking. It was an extraordinary kind of vision that he painted. And also, although he didn't want to say it, you do wonder whether there is a case actually for, in the end, maybe not Detroit, but for some cities, and maybe not even in America, but in Europe, just actually for being abandoned, that they should go back to farmland completely. It was an amazing, amazing image that he painted.
Well, some issues back, we talked about the empty quarters of Europe, that certainly there are parts of Germany, in former East Germany, you know, where it's simply too expensive to have essential services anymore. And yeah, there are vast tracts of Spain as well, which they're trying to repopulate in no small part and related to the migration story we had that focused on Spain in our last issue. And I could certainly see that. You know, I think the other interesting side, and Rob, I'm not sure what you thought about it, but when he was also talking, you know, off the back of your question about, you know, taking these, you know, reasonably skilled workers who are working on assembly lines for, you know, one of the big three in and around Detroit, and then moving them to watering carrots or making sure that the lettuce is happy, that's going to be quite a step, and I think quite a sales step in a way as well, because if you move from being, you know, on $27 an hour and suddenly you're going to be on $12, the quality of life equation and the sales pitch for how much better your life is going to be has to be rather grand.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's when people really have to take the quality of life equation by the scruff of the neck and think, well, I could be working the land and I could be doing something completely different. And of course, learning things and nurturing my own entrepreneurial streak while I do it. But I'm not going to be in a factory with a roof over my head. I'm going to be essentially in a factory with the blue sky over my head. Or maybe not in Detroit, maybe with a white sky threatening snow over my head. But it's an interesting question. Actually, I had a secondary question, which is about the music. You know, Detroit is the heart of Motown, which is obviously Motown itself. It's Stax, it's Chess Records. I think in 20 years' time, you know, Detroit, if Matt has his way, is going to be the center for folk music in the U.S. as well. It's going to take over Nashville.
Yeah, I think that whole idea of sort of, yeah, grow town and what could come off the back of it, you know, as well. And just, you know, as you were saying, the fact that he touched around this, the edge of the pop culture currency that the city has, but you know, it'll be a radically different place, and it'll be interesting to see how much of the edge is certainly erased, you know, if it goes down this path. And I have a bit of a confession to make. When we were away for the break, I was laid by the mayor.
Man, what did he do? Hitch up your grass skirt? How does that work?
Well, first... This is, you know, perhaps one of the challenges of being an audio format. When he walked in and he said that he was, well, he told us that he's part Samoan and part German, yet stacked on top of each other, he's about 8 feet tall. Anyway, yeah, he gave don't picture anything, Rob. Anyway, I'm wearing his lei now. we posed for a picture and he did the hang five?
The lei
sign, over. Anyway.
Well, I was going to say, we can hang it on the wall next to our picture from when we went to the tourism show in Berlin, where we had our picture taken with the stuffed tigers on the Indian stand.
Nice. Yes, my collection of urban leaders around the world. But I thought an interesting gentleman as well, and you wouldn't mess with him either, I'll tell you that much.
Not with his lay on.
Or mine. Anyway, that's all for this 21st edition of the Monocle Weekly. Next week, I'm still on the road, and as I mentioned, I'll be joining Andrew in Tokyo, along with our Asia editor Fiona Wilson. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp in London and Charles Husson here in Honolulu. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, then please send us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And also, our new issue will be hitting newsstands around the world from next Wednesday. Before we go, I'd like to say a big thank you to everyone here at Hawaii Public Radio. But for now, from Honolulu, I'm Tyler Brulé.
In London, I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Bound.
More from Tokyo next week.